Thank you for tuning in to a brand new episode of Earning Their Stripes on the Fish Stripes podcast. With the 2019 minor league baseball season now complete, we are absorbing everything we've learned about Marlins prospects this season and getting ready to dive right back into it with the start of Arizona Fall League. Co-hosting along with Ethan Badaski, I am Eli Sussman, and we're joined by a very, very special guest. Eric Ose is the voice of the Marlins Class A affiliate Clinton Lumber Kings, providing radio play-by-play for the team the past three seasons, formerly as a Mariners affiliate and now as a Marlins affiliate. If you are a Fish Stripes subscriber, you are familiar with the many one-on-one interviews that he's conducted throughout the year, really making us feel like we know these talented players better than before. So after listening to Eric talk all summer long, it's an honor to finally chat with him directly here on the pod. Congrats on surviving an extra long season, Eric, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a lot of fun, even with the extra work. It was my first playoff run, so it was a labor of love, but thank you for having me on.
Of course, and we wanted to start with the very basics because a lot of our audience is probably in South Florida. We even have some that are internationally, and they know that the team plays in Clinton, and they don't necessarily know what that means. Where in America Clinton is, exactly what the history of that team is, and how the city around the Lumber Kings interacts with the team. So could you just fill us in? Because you've been there now a few years, and for people that haven't been there before, just paint a picture of what it's like living there, the climate that people are battling with, and just the whole experience of playing minor league ball in Clinton, Iowa.
Yeah, so this is my just finished third season with the Clinton Lumber Kings, and I guess the best way to describe it is it's, you know, like Iowa, the Midwest, very cold during the winter and into the beginning of the season. And then it starts to heat up in, you know, July and August. You get a lot of bugs that come out too, which I know was an issue for our players, especially in May, because in the beginning it's gnats, and then it, you know, upgrades to shadflies, which are these larger flies that will hatch and then are so large that they'll show up on radar weather patterns. So one of the elements to contend with, I suppose, in the Midwest. But it's along the Mississippi River. So it's eastern Iowa. It's about a half an hour, maybe 45-minute drive, depending on how heavy that lead foot of yours is from the Quad Cities area, which is also in our league, the River Bandits. They're the Houston Astros single-A affiliate. And it's, you know, as a San Diego native, the winter is what I mainly focus on. And I think a lot of the guys who come from the warmer climates when they first come out here to Clinton is also something that they focus on because, you know, they haven't seen snow a lot of the times, and we'll have snow outs through the first couple of months of the season. And that definitely takes some getting used to, especially if you're coming from a tropical environment like the Dominican Republic. The town itself, Clinton, is a smaller town. It used to be a manufacturing hub for lumber, which is why we're the Lumber Kings. They used to make furniture here. In fact, at one point, I'm told in the 1900s, it had the most millionaires per capita in its county. And after that, it kind of gone away, its heyday being in the 50s. The population has kind of been shrinking. And so it's kind of a Midwest town that, you know, has had its struggles over recent years. But through all of that, it's had a minor league baseball team. Wow. The Clinton Lumber Kings are the only remaining charter member from the Midwest League going back to 1954. Before that, they even had professional baseball here in the 1900s with terrible team names like the Orphans and the Infants and the Children, which I'm glad to say those days are done. And so when the Midwest League came into being in 54, originally as the Mississippi-Ohio Valley League and then changing its name to its current name in 56, it brought that stability. And, you know, of all the teams that have come through, Clinton is the only remaining member left, and it's community owned, which is why it stayed in that area for so long, because there's no, you know, CEO that wants to move to a larger market and make bigger profits. It's owned by the city and its shareholders. And so, you know, if you live in Clinton and you're part of the community, you're not going to move it for more money. So here we are, you know, I guess 64 seasons into this now.
That's unbelievable. So as a community owned team, I'm sure there's a strong fan base around the team. And I think it's always interesting when you know, affiliates get switched around and everything. And obviously the Marlins had to switch with going from the Greensboro Grasshoppers to the Clinton Lumber Kings. So I'm just interested, how does the fan base react to brand new players, a brand new team, a brand new system coming through the town? And do fans kind of shift, like, you know, where there are a lot of Seattle Mariners fans and then all of a sudden they turn to being Marlins fans, or are they always just kind of fans of the Lumber Kings and they stay true to the town and everything? It's kind of always interesting to me when affiliates switch like that.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been in a couple of other minor league outposts throughout my career, and I can honestly tell you that winning matters the most of all the places I've been is in Clinton. Mm-hmm. And you can see that on the road when we were in the playoffs. You know, we were in Kane County, a suburb of Chicago, you know, a city of millions of people, and they drew, I think, like just over 600 people, and we had 200 more fans than that. And I can tell you half the crowd was probably Lumber Kings fans that had come out that way because it was only a 2.5-hour drive from Clinton. And that's sort of the fan base that you get here in Clinton. And so while I imagine further down the road, these people will start, you know, their affiliations as far as fans will start to lean more Marlins than it did Mariners in the past. A lot of these fans are mainly focused on, you know, former Lumber Kings that they have had an attachment with that have gone off to the major leagues. So, you know, a lot of fans are still Tyler O'Neill fans, and they may have been, you know, hoping for him to become a Mariner. Well, he ended up making the big leagues as a Cardinal. They still go down to St. Louis, and he still talks to the host family that's here in Clinton, and they're very close. And that's the type of the relationships that we have in a smaller ballpark, too. It's very intimate, very close. So a lot of these players and coaches, you know, over the course of a 140-game schedule plus the playoffs that we just got through, it's easy to form those types of attachments. And like I said, winning matters just more in Clinton than it does in other places, which is kind of unfortunate that there's a playoff or a championship drought going back to 1991 that they haven't had a chance to celebrate. But we could see that in our following. In the first half, we were a team that struggled, I would say, for the most part, just to get above the 500 mark. And then in the second half, we were a playoff contending team from the beginning, and the stadium was louder. The crowds were better. People would ask you more questions, you know, just about, you know, what certain wins and losses meant in the grand playoff picture. And that type of involvement and type of just curiousness, like, doesn't exist in a whole lot of other minor league places that I hope some of the players, which I'm sure they'll realize as they go on to, you know, other minor league teams on their way up to the big leagues, they'll start to realize maybe a little bit more that in some markets, the promotions and the just going to the game is the big draw. And, you know, the score in and of itself is kind of a secondary concern. Not the case in Clinton. It's a ballpark built in 1937. So if you're coming to a Lumber Kings game, you're there for the baseball. Now, we have a couple of modern amenities like a ribbon board in right field. That's really just score and, you know, stats and things like that. There's not a whole lot as far as video production going on there. And it's a really interesting and unique park because it has that 1937 feel, and it's only had a major renovation one time in that period. So kind of the history of baseball in Clinton is something that is one of the first things a fan will tell you about, you know, as far as the players and the things that they've seen come through here over the years.
So right. I got a couple follow-ups based off that. I just want to ask one thing first right away. You mentioned the first half struggles juxtaposed against the second half success. What do you contribute that more to? Do you contribute it to the weather heating up? Because we saw a lot of guys get much better. Like Connor Scott was one example. He got a lot better when the weather started heating up. Or do you kind of contribute it to the influx of talent that came in after the Marlins had a really nice draft for themselves?
Well, I think it's, you know, a mixture of the two. I know Mike was telling us, that was our manager, Mike Jacobs, this year. You know, a lot of the troubles early on in the season had to do with these errors that you would, you know, kind of shake your head at, you know, even at the single A level of just like, well, what's going on here? And, you know, Mike explains to you that, you know, it's the Midwest and it's April and, you know, it's 20 degrees out right now. And so it's pretty cold. And so you just see guys in the beginning parts of the month, you know, kind of spaz out a little bit in the outfield or in the infield, just start all of a sudden start running in place furiously. And they're just trying to get some kind of feeling in their body right there. And so it can be tough to, you know, stay on your toes in the infield. And we definitely, that affected us. Our defense was bad. I mean, you can almost make call it atrocious at times in the first half because we were leading all professional baseball in errors at one point in the first half. Which is never a category you envision yourself being in or at least wanting to be in. And, you know, I think also it speaks to the development of those prospects. So we had Connor Scott, you know, day one, opening day, you know, first round pick. So obviously a lot of attention and a lot of expectations go into that. But at the end of the day, you have to consider, you know, he's 19 years old when he comes to you. You know, the Marlins, I think we talked to Dick Scott about this on our pregame show. We're pretty honest, you know, hey, we're pushing this kid. You don't see too many 19-year-olds in the Midwest League. It's a pretty tall order to fill. And I think, you know, Connor's talent kind of speaks to him figuring things out a little bit. I think the weather, he'll be the first to tell you, a Florida kid, it helped when it warmed up, as I always would remind him, like, I promise, man, it's not always this cold. He's like, yeah, I'll prove it. You just kind of started to see him figure things out. And I think the hitting streak is probably the first thing that, if you watch this team from the very beginning, you started to realize, oh, you know, Connor's becoming, a tour of force, you know, 16-game hitting streak at the beginning of July that ended on the 26th. And a lot of that had to do with doubles. And you started to see Scott use all fields. And that's what Mike was so excited about in that instance, that you could see a younger left-handed batter that was, you know, now going out to left field, and he was getting doubles down the line, or he was putting balls into the gap in left center field. That part of his game just wasn't there at the beginning of the season. And so I think there was development. I mean, that it's kind of funny because you think about it, you know, when you follow it every day, like, it's Major League Baseball, the winning does this and that, but in minor league baseball, you're there to develop. And Connor Scott and Thomas Jones and Christopher Torres are the big names that I would consider, mm-hmm. as far as seeing them from opening day to the end of the season and just seeing, like, wow, it's an impressive movement as far as what we saw on the field between those types of talent, which is good to hear for Marlins fans, because those are some of the top 30 prospects.
Right. And before we get into more specific players, you did mention Mike Jacobs, the manager at Clinton. He was a promotion of sorts for him being in Batavia the previous year. He was a guest on one of our favorite Marlins podcasts called Swings and Misses, and he was pretty blunt about the fact that he aspires to be a major league manager someday, and he is held in a very high regard within the organization. Just to give an overview to people that may not have been following the team, Clinton went 78-61 during the regular season. Your run differential plus 112 was legitimized that record. This was a really dominant team. And although they had, especially during that second half, as you mentioned, coming up at the end of the year, and they did it with some of the top prospects in the Marlins organization, but not necessarily those slam dunk future Major League All-Stars that are ranked in the top 100 across Major League Baseball. It was a good group, but you could say that Mike Jacobs maybe got the most out of these players just from being around him, speaking to him a lot. I know you had him on a podcast episode earlier. How would you describe him as a leader or as a tactician? Is there anything in particular that sticks out to you? Because I know he is impressing other people within the Marlins organization for what he does at leading these young players.
Yeah, Mike, I mean, you can't say too much about the impression that Mike made on a lot of people and also fans too in this market. And he's very close to his guys. This was probably made obvious when we did have him on A-Ball. He was our first episode, and he was talking about, you know, the guys that he came from Batavia, and in particular highlighting guys that, you know, you got attached to because you're with them during the regular season. And it really, I think what it spoke to is just the faith that he had in these players. Mike's a big believer in the team that he has. He's a big believer in the guys in his clubhouse. I thought what really highlighted that for me, as far as that belief, which is kind of odd to say because it came so late in the season and it was in the playoff run. But, you know, when you're in best of three game series, it's so interesting to be part of a roller coaster. You win game one and you're like, wow, we're one win away from going to the championship series. And then you lose game two and it's like, oh my God, we're one game away from the season ending. So, you know, in 48 hours, it can kind of spread all over. And, you know, Mike, I remember being interviewed after a game two loss in Cedar Rapids, which, you know, puts you on the brink of your season ending. It was no panic at all. It was just saying that, you know, the big faith that he had in the pitchers that were carrying essentially an offense that may have been lackadaisical at times, or even the hot bats like a Peyton Burdick that had, you know, won a monthly end of the year honor in August. You know, that was the faith that Mike had in these guys, that, you know, if we were going to potentially lose in that series, then it was going to be with a group of guys that he had same faith. And sure enough, the next day, the lineup doesn't change, you know, everything was just sort of business as usual. And I think in baseball that, especially in the minor leagues, when you're, you know, teaching these guys how to become hopefully major league players, it's so important just to ingrain in them the idea of not getting too high or getting too low. Because I've talked to players before at the beginning of the season, and they'll say, and you'll ask them, hey, what is it going to be like to play 140 games? Because that's a lot of baseball, and you've never played anything like that, even in your, you know, advanced amateur career, and most of them will tell you, like, I'm not afraid of it. I've prepared myself. And at the end of the year, they'll tell you, like, yeah, it was a grind. And to have someone like Mike Jacobs, who had major league experience, who had been with a lot of these guys in Batavia, I think makes one of the biggest challenges of a full season minor league affiliate like the Lumber Kings are, you know, possible, that you could get over that. And I think Mike, that was, you know, also just to his coaching staff of Mark DeFelice and Frank Moore as well, and getting those guys. I never heard a negative word from any of our players that had come through about the coaching staff, and usually a lot of credit was given to them after runs of success that we had had.
I want to get to some guys, and you talked about the development that these young guys had under Mike Jacobs, and one guy I really want to talk about is Chris Torres. How in the world did this guy put together a respectable season after the start he had? I mean, it felt like he was hitting under the Mendoza line for almost the entire season, striking out above 30%, and he was always getting his walks. I mean, he walked at nearly a 15% clip, and that's something he's done his entire career, but he got the average up over 230. I mean, he didn't slug a ton for a guy who's shown some prowess to do that in his career, but I mean, how did he put together even a respectable stat line? Did he get that hot at the end of the year?
He did get that hot, but it was so impressive to watch, because, like you said, when you looked at his first half numbers, you would have just written it off and just been like, oh my God, you know, this was a top 30 guy, and don't expect too much from Chris. But you know, I think that, again, this speaks a little bit to Mike Jacobs. So I'm looking at our game notes that we had here. You know, Chris played for the Lumber Kings as pretty much their everyday shortstop, but Mike Jacobs was always putting him atop the lineup. So by the end of the season, he had been the leadoff hitter for the Lumber Kings in 68 of their games. And, you know, Chris did miss a decent amount of time early in the season with what was a leg injury, and then came back and was still struggling. And then I think, you know, speaking to the hotness, and just mathematically to ask you how he turned it around, it's quite simple. He had a 19-game hitting streak from July 8th through August 1st. And, you know, he was doubled all over the place. Yeah, you know, he had 19 straight games, and the average during that clip, I think, was around 350 or a little bit higher than that. That'll help turn around from the interstate, as they call it, the 100 average. And I think also, too, for Chris early in the season, I do feel like the defensive slump, if there is such a thing, had affected him at the plate, because this was a guy who really struggled in the early months with the errors. It was a big reason why the Lumber Kings were leading the league in errors for the majority of the first half in that cold weather. And you kind of see that, you know, affect his confidence when he'd come to the plate, and, you know, those errors had kind of come with him. But, you know, the weather heated up, the defense, it got better, the bat got better, even the power started to show up a little bit as far as not – home runs, I don't think anyone would tell you that Chris is going to, you know, hit 20 home runs in a season, but he has surprising power that'll show up every once in a while for a switch hitter. And also, you know, his speed is probably the first thing that people will think about offensively, along with that patience, which kind of play hand in hand, because he led the team in stolen bases. And that's another thing, too. You know, the confidence that carried over, I felt like, from his defense picking up in the second half. Also, man, he was incredibly confident on the base pass. He stole 25 bases for us, and he was only caught six times. And he had a swagger to him in the second half where it was just, you know, he was walking a little bit different. And I think it was just the belief that, you know, yeah, you know, I had turned around what was a miserable season. It was looking that way.
It was
a big reason why they made the playoffs in the second half.
And then one other guy that I really wanted to ask you about, when, you know, I heard we were having you on, and it's a guy that kind of flies under the radar in terms of this suddenly loaded Marlins draft class. I mean, there's a lot of guys that kind of jump out the page. Burdick is a guy, I'm sure we'll talk about him while we have you. But one guy that kind of flew under the radar that had a really, really nice season is Evan Edwards. And he kind of fills a position of need for the Marlins as he played some first base this year. So I want to ask you about him and what you saw from him that shows that. I mean, I've said he can be a top 30 guy in this Marlins system, and his stat line was very impressive: 285, 361, 441 slash, and a 134 weighted runs created plus. So what did you see from Evan in this second half of the year that showed that this is a guy that Marlins fans should be really excited about, and he can really contribute to this organization?
Yeah, Evan was a huge upgrade for us. So before that, we had Sean Reynolds, who was had 145
Eli's
strikeouts.
Man.
I think so much of Sean, like intangibly and the skills he has, but I know he was going through a tough time offensively.
He was, yeah. And listen, Sean's a great guy too, and I don't think he would tell you that he was setting the world on fire out here. He's a very honest guy. But, you know, he was struggling here, and so that was a hole for us at first base, you know, with 145 strikeouts in just the first half of play. First base was an issue for us, and when we got Evan Edwards, two things immediately improved was, you know, a lack of strikeouts, which tended to keep rallies alive, which played off, you know, the emerging bats of, you know, Connor was still with us and Christopher Torres. But on top of that, what everyone will talk about is just the defense of Evan Edwards. The guy, I think, potentially could win Gold Gloves at first base. He's really special to watch at first, which is not a position that I think to untrained eyes is easy to notice when a player is really decent at because
you don't really
have to throw off your – you don't get to show off your arm or anything like that. But just quick reactions, not too much got past Evan at first. And also just, you know, a big part of fielding the position at first is the footwork of knowing also where to go, how far off the bag you can go, when you need to cover first, when you need help on a pitcher or even a second baseman. And that just, I think, shored up our entire right side of the infield. And so Evan Edwards' defense, you can't really say enough. And then on top of that, you factor in the impressive numbers that he had offensively, which is a left-handed bat, as I guess you'd imagine for a first baseman. He's a more mature player as well, so I imagine his development clock is a little bit set forward since he went to college and came out of his senior year. The offense that you see with Edwards, too, I feel like the power will be coming as well because you saw the flashes of it. I think he had 8 home runs in the regular season with us and then hit a very big home run for us in the postseason run in Game 1, in fact, of our Western Division Championship Series and was one of our most successful hitters, too, in the Midwest League Championship Series, and we didn't have a whole lot of those. So that was impressive to see from Evan, and it felt like right when he jumped in, because I'll tell you the story, when Evan first came in to the Lumber Kings, we were on the road in Wisconsin, and I saw a new name in the lineup, which to a broadcaster at the single-A level means, oh, man, I've got some work to do because I got a roster move to send out. And I ask, you know, our manager, Mike, like, hey, so a new guy goes, yeah, Evan, he won't be doing BP, no on-field work. He's going to get here, put his jersey on, he'll be in the lineup. Well, he had, I think, 4 RBIs in that game and had gone 3-for-4 with a couple of doubles. And so I go, is that the plan every day? I go, no, it's very impressive. And I think he had another multi-hit game the second day he was with us as well. And so it kind of speaks to, I guess, the natural talent that Evan Edwards has. He was a huge part of what we put together in the second half, and I think speaks to the embarrassment of riches that we had, that at the end of our season, we were batting Edwards 7th or 8th. I mean, that just speaks to the amount of talent that was here in Clinton by the end of the season.
As we're speaking, the 2019 minor league season is officially ending with the AAA championship game, but not even a full day later, there's more minor league baseball taking place all the way in Arizona, in the Arizona Fall League. And just like all the other major league teams, the Marlins are sending a handful of players. And the reason why this is so convenient, not just the timing of the Fall League starting up, but that we have Eric on, is that you saw 4 different players that are going to be representing the Marlins in the Arizona Fall League this year. And it's one of the premier opportunities for top prospects to play against one another. It's a very big test for these guys. And as someone that saw them in person, I wanted to get just very quick scouting reports, if you will, on these particular guys that we haven't already mentioned. The first is one that you got the smallest taste of just at the very end of the year, shortstop Jose Devers, who's actually going to be playing second base in the Fall League. I was watching a lot of those playoff games and listening to you calling it. He only played a handful of games and struggled a little bit at the plate, but he's one of the most highly ranked prospects that passed through Clinton at any point this year. So I'm wondering, first with Devers, and then we'll get to a few of the other guys, just any observations you have from watching him play in that really small sample?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure exactly what Devers' situation was when he came here, because he only appeared in 3 games during the regular season and actually did very well. You know, obviously limited sample size, only 3 games, but, you know, 500 average with a couple of doubles and a couple of RBIs in that span isn't too bad for a 19-year-old. And he was just a perfect fit for this roster because I would think everyone who followed this team, even casually, would have noticed that we were missing a second baseman for the better part of the second half, really after Demetrius Sims' promotion. But Devers, in that time, left-handed batter, incredibly speedy in the postseason, only 19 years of age. It did seem like at times he was a bit outmatched, in particular against Riley Thompson, who's a top prospect in the Cubs organization, in particular in game three where he faced him twice and struck out both times. I think he only saw like seven pitches or something from the guy in those two at-bats. But, I mean, Devers plays a really good second base. I know he's coming up as a shortstop, and I think because of the Hurricanes actually out in Florida is why he was able to come through us as late as he did and still be on the postseason roster. But in that brief time, you can see that he goes the opposite way, which is, I know, tough to do for kids that are that young. He's got the genes because his cousin is Rafael Devers with the Boston Red Sox. Right. So it's a very limited sample size for me, but you could see that he was doing stuff that you don't expect too many 19-year-olds to be doing. I just wish I could have seen it in a larger body and if maybe seen a couple more at bats and, his work in the field, because I'm not sure if that's where they plan on sending him to second. Cause I know the Marlins have so many middle infielders, in particular at short. Seems like they'll have to be moving some furniture around to make guys fit.
Yeah. Well, someone you saw in a larger body, both figuratively and then literally, is Gerard Encarnacion, who started the year playing every single day in Clinton, really lit it up as their top run producer for much of the first half, had a well-deserved promotion. He's another one that's heading to the fall league. And honestly, as someone that oversees the entire Marlins farm system, he might be the one hitter that made the biggest leap based on the preseason perception of him to where he is now. Any direction you want to go with that about what makes Gerard special?
I am incredibly high on Gerard Encarnacion. In fact, every year the broadcasters in this league are asked by Fangraph to fill in a top 10. And I think he was the only one that I put in all caps. He needs to be in a top 30 prospect list. I'm so sick of being the guy explaining, who Gerard Encarnacion is. I just wish that a lot of my work would be done beforehand because that's the type of guy he is. Lots and lots of power. He's a big frame, cannon for an arm in right field. He only missed one game for the Lumber Kings, and that was in Bowling Green, I remember. He scored a run, and he had tweaked his left ankle on the slide to the plate, and then tried to play the next day, and then came out in like the seventh or eighth inning, and they sat him out for a game as precaution and also as a lesson, like, hey, tell us next time, something's hurting you so we can put the kibosh on this stuff quickly. It was the only game he missed with us. So he was, every day with us in the middle of the lineup. The most fun thing I liked watching about Gerard was just his arm. His story is incredibly fun. This guy was discovered on the streets in the Dominican Republic by scouts. He just happened to be walking by and saw him playing essentially a street ball game in his native Dominican. Incredibly confident guy too. And we had him on the podcast through Nestor Bautista, who was our translator. I asked him what his goal was for the season, and he goes, to play in the major leagues. I'm like, oh, that's great. He goes, no, this year, play in the major leagues. Like, okay, Wow. Well, that's good luck. But I admire the confidence. But that, I think that also speaks to the type of season that he was having and, obviously the promotion that he had gotten, because he was easily put our biggest bat. And to see him now in the top 30, last I'd seen from MLB.com, they ranked Gerard 17th, which is pretty good considering he wasn't even on the list at the beginning of the season. And I think just goes to show you the type of season he had. Talking with Dick Scott, the director of player development with the Marlins, when he had come through, he was saying that this was a guy that, the Marlins had thought very highly of, and I think now the rest of baseball is now beginning to see why he has such a high reputation in the organization. So I'm really interested to be following Gerard as as his career unfolds, because he's got too much talent, I feel like, to not be in a major league uniform at some point. Maybe obviously not this year, but somewhere down the road.
Right. And two more guys heading to the fall league, very different type of players from Gerard, are relievers Alex Vesia and CJ Carter, both of them with the Lumber Kings initially, and they had so much success once they moved to Jupiter that they even finished the year actually in Jacksonville at AA. Very different styles, both guys that just joined the organization last year in the draft. And frankly, I think you may have gotten the short end of the stick in watching them, because they pitched even better once they moved up to a higher level of competition than they did when they were in Clinton. In fact, with Vesia in particular, statistically, he's one of the most dominant pitchers with no qualification in all of minor league baseball ever since turning pro and joining the draft. I did get a little bit of a look at them once they moved up to Jupiter, but they have very different styles, I know. And the fact that they're already in the fall league, and as anybody that follows the Marlins at the major league level knows, they have so many holes in the bullpen and guys that have any potential, even in like special situations, to get batters out can be fast tracked through the system fairly quickly. So with those two guys that are heading to the fall league, Vesia and Carter, could you describe exactly what exactly makes them successful? And yeah, what you got to know about them during their time in Clinton?
Yeah, well, Carter is pretty easy to spot if you've seen him pitch. A very low arm angle, almost submarine. So he was someone that early on in the season, as you're trying to get accustomed to who's warming up in the bullpen, you didn't need to bring out the binoculars for. You could just see that low arm angle. And that's where a lot of the deception comes from C.J. Carter. The ball can sometimes, it looks like, rise on guys. And so he worked a little higher in the zone than I was talking with Mark DeFelice about this. Him and Zach Wolf would work a little higher in the zone because they also had those higher spin rates. And so they were actually encouraged to, you know, throw those fastballs high in the zone because they could get the swings and misses that other pitchers couldn't get. And so Carter, at times would be a little wild, I felt like, but you know, it's so impressive because he was obviously well deserving of his promotion by the time it had come around for him, and to see him end his season in Double A like Alex Vesia is pretty remarkable, because you don't really see that a whole lot at all in the Single A level to jump that to jump a couple levels in one season. Both great guys too. We had him out for community outings. Vesia, I know, was a starter back in his college days and was moved into the bullpen. When we had him on the podcast, he was saying, you know, he's in Burlington, which doesn't draw too well. And he was coming off the mound after one of his appearances, and he said he was looking around. He said, man, this is just so great, you know, being, you know, with a regular team and just playing every day, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, there was only 450 people here last night, which is the announced crowd. So it's going to get a little, it's going to get even better for you, Alex.
Right.
And so he was so integral to our first half, the success that we had at times, although unfortunately it was never strung together because he was a left-handed option, which we didn't have a whole lot. And at that time, Manuel Rodriguez was in our starting rotation. So to have someone coming out of the bullpen as a left-handed option, I thought really helped what was an issue for us in the first half, which was blown saves and just leads that weren't being able to be held. And Vesia and I felt C.J. Carter were a lot of the times you would see them come in as sort of a 1-2 punch in those later innings. Carter would, if memory serves correct, because this is back in the first half, wouldn't typically work as long as Vesia, but I think that just speaks to his, you know, pedigree as a starter coming in and him being told once he got signed by the Marlins that we envision you more in the bullpen. And, you know, Vesia, if you ever get a chance to talk to him, he's the easiest guy to get along with. So be like, all right, sounds good. I'm excited for that. So, you know, he jumped in with both feet, and I think it just shows also the talent that he has, because like Carter, you know, he's ending his season in Jacksonville in the Southern League. It's just maybe we could have used those arms in the postseason round, but I think we managed all right. But they were both guys that I felt like maybe developmentally Carter maybe advanced. You could see more of that development because he did have some refinement, I felt like, in the first half with the Lumber Kings before his promotion. And Alex Vesia just seemed like, you know, he was kind of locked down from the moment that it had started going. I remember when we had Carter out for our community outing at one place, he was talking to some of the kids, and they were asking him, like, when did he start, you know, playing catch? And he said that he had trouble putting the baseball mitt down and a glove down or in the ball down when he was a kid, and that his mom would always have to drag him by the ear into the house to stop him playing baseball because he just couldn't stop doing it, which I think speaks to the love of the game for these guys too, but also a reason why Carter's pitching professionally and, you know, ending his season in the Double-A ranks.
Yeah, the one thing that I've talked to Vesia about is that getting all the way up to Double-A at the end of the year, that's a league where occasionally the pitcher spot has to come up. And although he was still working exclusively in relief, there was one crazy extra inning game where they ran out of players and he had to bat for himself. with the bases loaded in a tie game. I think there were even two outs. And in his first career plate appearance professionally, he draws a walk, and it's a walk-off walk to drive him around with the bases loaded. And I don't know whether he made the highlight package himself or whether it was one of his representatives, but he put together a highlight reel of his season. And the longest highlight and the end of the highlight reel is him drawing that walk and giving that post-game interview.
So that is great.
That goes to show the kind of personality that he has. And although he was just an extraordinary pitcher himself, the fact that he took so much joy in stepping up in that situation, knowing he probably didn't belong there, but being able to execute in that situation, that's a moment he'll take with him forever, probably.
That is Alex Vesia. He is infectious, too. He's always looking to have a good time. So it doesn't surprise me at all, though it's very funny to hear.
So, Eric, one thing that I absolutely love about the minor leagues, and besides the obvious, which is the nicknames for teams, is just the minor league lifestyle and living in towns like Clinton and some of the other places like the Marlins are going to Wichita with AAA next year. So one thing that I really wanted to ask you about, and I'm sure you have a great one because you're in such a location that just screams minor league baseball, is a great story about minor league life on the road or just an experience you've had that just represents that minor league lifestyle the most.
Oh man. I don't know. I don't have too many PG ones. But I don't know if I can pick out one in particular. I'll tell you one when we were in South Bend, which I guess, you know, encapsulates minor league baseball because everything is done, you know, travel wise via the bus. And so my first year in the with the team with the Lumber Kings, we're on a road trip in South Bend, and it's beautiful stadium, Four Winds Field, and this was before they had the minor league extra inning rule where they put the guy at second base. And So the games tended to last longer, and I think one of the reasons why they put the rule in is they actually highlighted this game in particular. So we were part of history in that regard. So it went 18 innings. They have a Midwest League rule of a curfew. I think it's like 2:30 in the morning. But the way the game had gone is we were down 1-0, I want to say. And then foul ball was hit off the forearm of the umpire, and I think it broke a forearm or some bone in his arm, and he couldn't continue. And so there was about a 35-40 minute delay because there's only a two-man crew in single-A baseball, and so they needed to switch the gears. So they had to take a break. Everyone went and got their concession items. He came out down to one umpire, and the Cubs were beating the Lumber Kings 1-0. Well, we hit a two-run homer and we're up 2-1 going into the ninth, thinking, all right, great, we're going to win this one. And we give up a run in the ninth, so it goes into extra. It goes into the 10th, the 11th, the 12th, the 13th, the 14th, the 15th, the 16th, the 17th. It goes into the 18th inning with one umpire this whole time. And so they wave it off. You know, it's still tied at 2, and they wave it off. They go, it's 2:30 in the morning. We can't continue. We'll come back and finish it tomorrow as part of before the regularly scheduled game. So the umpire walks off, and there's maybe 4 or 5 people left in the crowd, as you can imagine, one of which is our bus driver. And he got a standing ovation, this umpire, from the crowd that was there for the work that he had done solo in
That's
this game.
That's incredible.
And so we get on the bus. I'll never forget this. And I just want to go back to the hotel. It's been a long night, you know, because I'm a one-man band for these games. And so I've been talking for close to 5 hours to myself like a crazy person. And get on the bus. Guy turns the engine over. It won't turn over. Turns it. The bus broke down. So it's 2:30 in the morning. Actually, probably closer to 3 now. Bus is broken down in the parking lot. Now, the hotel is only like a 5-minute walk away, so I'm just contemplating, like, should I just walk? Like, I'm just so over today. And not thinking that this was a fun minor league story at the time, mind you, too. Well, the bus ends up working again 30, 40 minutes later. I wanted to get something to drink, I remember, and I went to a vending machine, and I wanted a bottle of water, and it was all sold out, and all they had was, like, soda, and I thought it was too late in the night or early in the morning for that, so I went to get my change back, and the night ended with me getting, like, $3 in nickels and dimes. Like, I hit a slot in Vegas, and I just remember looking up to the heavens, cursing the gods for the life decisions that I had made bringing me to this point.
That's what I'm going to tell you. Will Stewart had a really good one about bed bugs somewhere in the middle of Ohio.
Ooh.
But that might have topped it, honestly. That's one of the best, because we've been asking that question all season long, and that's definitely one of the better ones we had. So really appreciate you sharing that.
I'm glad my misery can win a prize.
Eric, this was really terrific. And once again, we thank you for being part of Fish Stripes in some way during this regular season and covering the team the way you did, because you really brought us inside these players' experiences. And it was such a fun year to have. And if we trust in the organization to continue building up this farm system, you'll have a great crop of players to cover next season. Look forward to seeing some of these guys in the fall league and then hearing more of you in 2020.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. Take care.